Hey, everybody, welcome back to another fantastic installment of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. We have two really awesome guests for you today in the show, and we're going to get to that in just a second. But I want to tell you about some of the sponsors we have on this podcast that help us out a little bit, and we love the support. Local and small business. So we're lucky enough to have two brewery sponsors on the podcast. One of them happens to be Manskirt Brewing, located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, right in the old bank building on Main Street. If you have ever been to Manskirt, you know that's an awesome place to hang. And they have rotating seasonal taps. And it's just there's a lot of room. Go play games, listen to music, and just obviously drink some amazing beer. They just put Imperial Progress into cans. It's their double dry hopped Imperial IPA. They also got a Robbie Burns party coming on February 3rd. Check Facebook for more info. So go give them some love. Longtime sponsor of ours, that is Manskirt Brewing. Now, the second brewery on this podcast that we've been working with for quite a while now is Demented Brewing. Demented Brewing, they're located in Middlesex, New Jersey, in one of the coolest facilities that I could think of. Just awesome murals on the wall. 16 rotating tap handles every Sunday. They have a different release. They just released Greed, their oatmeal stout, on draft in their tasting room. They're going to be releasing Requiem, their dry hopped lager, this Sunday on draft in their tasting room. So go check them out. Go watch the football game there. Have like one to maybe 26 different pints. But that is Demented Brewing. Now, Susan Robb is a woman who helps us get some of the guests here on the show. Paul Templer, Bob Rathbun, Coach Jim Johnson, a lot of really interesting names and people. And she and Kim Ward and Paul Templer, they have started the Nepal Outreach Program and really looking for donations. Their goal is to reach $25,000 through individual and corporate sponsorships. And in just a few weeks, they've already raised $5,000. And this is going to put 15 kids into school and supply 17 ladies and moms with sewing supplies to start a business where they're making these really beautiful quilts. I saw one for the first time on one of our Instagram posts. Just a really good foundation. So Templar Foundation is a non-for-profit 501c3. The mission is to secure the house for the first 50 women and put all 17 kids into school this year. So they have already raised money. They've sold 10 quilts all around in different countries. So they are on their way. But they need more. So Kim and Susan are tirelessly appealing to their network and beyond for donations of any size. It's a really good cause, guys. So go make a donation at the GoFundMe Nepal Outreach Program or donate through Twitter at Kim Marie Ward or M Susan Robb. That's Susan Robb, M Susan Robb, ROBB3 on Twitter. So that is the Nepal Outreach Program. And finally, a trivia revolution fueled by craft beer. We are a trivia company located all throughout the state of New Jersey in craft beer bars and breweries. Go out and play trivia one night. It's free to play. You can win prizes to different breweries all around the state. It's just an awesome time. You can be in last place and win prizes. I host on Wednesdays at Tap House 15. So come on out. That is Trivia Revolution fueled by craft beer. Now, we have two really, really interesting guests today. Now, first, you're going to hear from Mike Stern. Mike Stern is an animator for Pixar. It's just really cool listening to him. He's worked on the new movie Coco. He's working on Incredibles 2. He's worked on How to Train Your Dragon, Cars, the Toy Story shorts. It's just really interesting. It's amazing what people do for a living. So Mike Stern, you're going to hear first. And then you're going to hear from a guy named Sean Sweeney. And he works with the Jane Goodall Foundation. Yes, that Jane Goodall, like top 50 influential woman in the world, Jane Goodall, with her work with chimpanzees and conservation. And he gives us an insight to what that organization does, the Jane Goodall Institute. So a really, really interesting podcast that we are very proud of. So with that, enjoy the podcast.
Hey, I'm Mike Stern. I'm Nick with Pixar, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
Hello, this is Sean Sweeney from the Jane Goodall Institute. You've been listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun. Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cruel and tragic. Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Time to get Irish.
Oh, yes. Welcome back, everybody, to episode 183, I think, something like that, of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Only 17 weeks till episode 200. You've been preparing?
Yeah. I talked to a person who said they've heard of us before, and they have a 2% chance of joining us.
All right. So you have 17 weeks to put together
I still think Garfunkel will come in for number 200.
Who's the guy you think you've sent the most emails to? Mine's that, or tweet. I've tried Kemp at least 27 times.
Most emails, it could be Dogfish, you know, trying to arrange that.
Yep. I tried, Kemp's the obvious one, only because we had him.
Mm-hmm.
If we had never gotten him, this saga would have been over a long time ago.
I think that's the same thing with Dogfish, where they said they would love to do it, but I guess their schedules are so jam-packed, it's like, no matter how many times you say it, it's like, yeah, we're still busy.
If you weren't so busy pissing off the firemen and Bigfoot hunters.
Yeah. And,
for those of you who don't know, Mike was trying to get some Bigfoot hunter on. Mm-hmm. You said something about missing children, and we were going to make a joke about it.
It was a Bigfoot hunter, and he also has a side job where he looks for missing children. And I sent kind of our general tweet at the time, where like, hey, we'd love to talk to you about your work with searching for Bigfoot, and your work with this project, blah blah blah. And he came back with a reply, which. He's basically like, I don't see anything funny when missing children. I will not participate in your show. And, I sent the email back. We're not going to make fun of missing children. We'll talk about it. It's interesting. But he never replied back to it.
Like, look, we wouldn't make fun of the missing children until the week after your episode.
Yeah. Are you afraid that Bigfoot has the children, and that's why you can't find either?
But what is he worried about? It's not like the kids are going to hear this.
Yeah. Wait, we have a caller. It's one of the kids you're trying to find. I've been around for a week now.
We found him somehow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. I just did a Google search. He really should get his internet back.
But, we did that. I pissed off the shark guy. I said Eastern Time. He was on Eastern Time in Australia, which I assume...
You figure we'd have a name for each time zone that we wouldn't repeat it in any way.
I know, you can't have two Eastern zones.
Yeah.
But whatever. We are back today. Welcome back. Did you catch yourself up on any of this stuff from Donald Trump's book here? The Fire and Fury or whatever it is?
I've yet to read it. I'm sure I'll get to it eventually, but I mean, it's not
I won't
my...
read it. I'll just read the
yeah, probably.
Notes.
I mean, nothing in it would surprise me. I guess it's the bottom line of it all.
My favorite is that apparently he likes to eat McDonald's because he's afraid of being poisoned. like deathly afraid of being poisoned.
I heard he has very weird food habits. Like, all his steaks are well done to the point of burnt, and he and he covers it with ketchup. He constantly goes out for KFC, McDonald's, and everything like that. What else? I mean, they basically told Japan when he's doing a tour of Asia, don't give him any weird stuff. He's not into weird foods or anything like that. Just give him steaks. And the famous one is when he has people over and it's dessert time, the help specifically gives everybody one scoop of ice cream and gives him two scoops of ice cream.
I can just picture him, like, everyone awkwardly sitting around him, like, enjoying ice cream, and him just, like, trying to, like, non-verbally prod people to look that he has two scoops, like suggesting, like, looking
this
at
sounds
him.
Like a, something, like, a five-year-old would ask a genie for, it's like...
Or his mom, like, who's hosting the party, like, can I get... It's my party!
I have some coffee with that? Give me two cups of coffee. I will not be outdone.
I mean, I read a couple of them today. A bunch of them are, like, a lot of, like, that it's, like, completely unorganized, and people are, like, think he's a lunatic and all that.
It's the same stuff I've heard.
But I do like that he doesn't sleep in the same bed as his wife. Apparently, they sleep in separate rooms, which I find pretty interesting.
Mm.
He probably I picture
so
him
you
as
have
some kind
a
of tank,
hot, like, model wife.
Yep.
And you're just like, ew, get away. Yeah. I have to watch Fox News.
Well, come on. We know that marriage is a sham anyway. That's not real. She's
waiting for the money.
Exactly. But I don't know. I really like the idea of him having the McDonald's so he doesn't get poisoned.
Can you imagine, like, Russia pay some guy to dress up like Ronald McDonald or Grimace and
infiltrate McDonald's?
What were those mascots? And there was like a birdie in there. There was like the Fry Kids. There was like,
oh yeah,
they were like big pom poms.
There was like
legs.
A whole like world of McDonald's.
Yeah.
They had like all sorts of characters.
The hamburger,
the Grimace. Mm. There was a pilot that he looked like a pilot, like a duck kind of.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. It was like a chicken or something like that. The chicken McNuggets talked. I remember that.
McDonald's characters. Let's see. Who we got?
The most prepared show.
Grimace, the Hamburglar, obviously. Mm-hmm. How can we forget Mayor McCheese?
Oh! He's a part of Trump's cabinet.
If he keeps losing people.
Mayor McCheese, parenthesis, R, parenthesis.
So there's a whole, like, McDonald's wiki here. So we have Mac Tonight. He's the big moon head.
Yeah, I remember the crescent moon when it was like a big deal. We're open late. Yeah, Mac Tonight.
Birdie the early bird. She's like the bird with the pilot goggles.
Oh, okay.
Captain Crook.
I don't remember Captain Crook. We might have to. You think we can get him on the show?
No, I think we could have like a whole like bit on this next week. We really delve into some of the backstories of these guys. There's the Fry Kids. Those are the pom-pom
the
people.
The pom-pom people.
Officer Big Mac. He's the Big Mac head, but he's got like a cop uniform on.
He's the one like, hold it. Let me check for poison.
This is interesting. There's Uncle O'Grimacy. He's like Grimace, but he's green and fuzzy in shamrocks and stuff. So I wonder if he was like. There's the McNuggets that they like came out of the styrofoam. There's I Am Hungry.
I've never heard of
him. He's like
a
little green monster. There's Sunday. He looks like a polar bear. There's the Happy Meal Gang. apparently, there was a cartoon because there's a whole bunch of them. Ben Gunn, One Eyed Sally.
What?
I just read, okay? I'm
I don't know what's going on. I just read.
I just relayed the message here in McDonald's land.
Well, I know there was a McKids
There's
NES
apple pie
game.
Trees.
Hmm. That's what our agriculture is going to come down to. Take out all the nutrition. Just put it right into those egg roll looking pies.
I'm going to look into more of like the seedy underworld.
The untold story.
McDonald's people. But I was... you know, we were starting talking about like the whole engagement and wedding stuff, and you know, you start thinking on ideas, and you start seeing the price, and you know, you hear the idea of a destination wedding. So I, you know, started Googling some things, and you know, I'm thinking, but instead of maybe destination, maybe I'm going to just take some of the traditions from different places around the world. For their weddings.
Registration it for your idea.
Yeah, you want to hear some of these?
No.
Okay, well, it's all I got. So. we were thinking about possibly going to Ireland and Scotland for like a honeymoon, something like that. So maybe we should get in on the Scottish tradition of blackening the bride.
Oh.
Yeah. I think that's more of an Irish tradition, but, you know.
You figure they did the opposite in that country, but continue.
So all your friends are throwing disgusting things at you, covering you in, like, black oil and grossness, and then tying you to a tree. This typical premarital humiliation that Scottish brides endures is certain parts of the country. Supposedly, if you could handle their torture, you could handle anything, including marriage. So, like, all my friends, you guys would go take Alex out and, like, like cover her in, like, tar and tie her to a tree.
That's going to be hard to explain to the police. No, you don't understand.
We're just blackening the bride.
We're Scottish. You don't understand. We're going old school.
So, you know, maybe we bring that tradition on, you know.
I'd be for it. Yeah, if you Alex want. Might have a different opinion, but.
Yeah, you know, but. Hey. Maybe we'll go to China for a wedding.
All right.
Some weddings are usually... some weddings are accompanied by tears. Brides and females of the Tujia people in China take matters to a whole new level. Starting 1 month in advance, the bride starts to cry for 1 hour every day. 10 days into the ordeal, the mom joins the picture, and then 10 days later, the grandmother does the same. By the end of the month, every female in the family is crying alongside the bride. Well, why? It's actually supposed to be an expression of joy as the women weep in different tones, kind of like a song, a very salty, wet song.
Well, I heard Alex's family already started at the second they found out the news about you. But...
yeah, well, that's probably accurate.
I mean, once if you can't cry? I mean, you're supposed to fake cry for like an hour? Does somebody like throw something in your eyes?
That's North Korea where like certain people didn't weep hard enough, like when King John Il died or something like that. So it was like... It was like a fine if you didn't weep hard enough for him. And they made people
like
cry.
Every person was like cutting onions, like throwing lemon into their eyes. Nope.
Well, you know, save the dates are part of a wedding, right? You know,
of
you
course.
Save the date. So there's a group of people called the Dor, D-A-U-R, that live in Chinese Inner Mongolia. In order to finalize the wedding date, the bride and groom are required to kill a baby chick while holding the knife together. Then they proceed to gut the chick and inspect its liver. If the liver looks good, then they're allowed to set a date. If not, they have to repeat the process until they find a satisfactory liver.
You imagine there's like this chicken farm where all these chickens have disease. You're there for like 3 hours. Come on.
Just slaughtering chickens.
I impregnated her. We got to get through with this.
Well, as long as they don't check my liver. let's see. I was thinking maybe India. You know, my friend Taryn might know some places to take me. You know,
I was in India once.
Yeah, you might know some hot spots.
That's where I saw a dead body.
That's true.
I don't know if that has anything to do with engagements, but continue.
In India, women born as Mangaliks, which is an astrological combination when Mars and Saturn are born under the seventh house. I don't know what that means. Are thought to be cursed and likely to cause their husband an early death. In order to ward off this curse, they must be married first to a tree. The tree is then destroyed and the curse is broken.
Is it any tree in particular? Is it like a pine tree, a palm tree?
I mean, I'm assuming you would just pick a very attractive
like I just imagine tree. Like Francois goes over to India every year with a bunch of trees and marries them off. Yeah. That should be his side job when it's not the winter.
You could pitch it to him.
Yeah, that'll be the sequel to Tree Man. Tree Man 2, Indian Dreams.
We could go to Borneo, you know, like towards the rainforest.
Where is Borneo?
I think it's in South America. I think. All right. But I know there's a big rainforest there.
Gotcha.
So for tribes of the Tadong community in northern Borneo, newly married couples are required to be confined to their house while not emptying their bowels or urinating for 3 days and nights.
Okay, I would never get married in that country. I can barely go an hour.
I know, me too. Yes. No coffee, like...
Well, who's checking that? Is there like a guard in the bathroom? Like seriously, do they check your underwear just to make sure you didn't let a little go before the 3 days? What? That just sounds wrong. Who starts these traditions?
I don't know. We could go to Fiji, the nice place
of
Fiji.
Well, that sounds nice.
Not only are men expected to ask their father for the daughter-in-law, the daughter's hand in marriage, they're also expected to bring him a whale tooth. Let that sink in.
Is there like a target
excluding
somewhere?
Excluding the black market, the only place in the world to get a whale tooth is the mouth of a whale. Which also happens to spend most of its time underwater. So I guess you're eBaying whale teeth or you're going to like go kill whale, get his teeth.
I would just give him like some random tooth and like prove to me that's not a whale tooth.
I don't know, but maybe like it's just well known and like they know a whale tooth pretty well in that community.
That poor whale that swims around feeds you. Poor hermit. I just came by for some fish, and you guys keep stealing my tooth.
It's just like one sad whale, like off the coast of Fiji.
It's the bachelor whale. Not again.
Maybe Sudan, you know, maybe like an alternative kind of wedding. In southern Sudan, people of the Nuer tribe believe that a marriage is not complete until the woman has had two children. If she fails to do so, the groom's able to seek a divorce.
I mean, that's so if you accidentally impregnate her, you have the shotgun wedding, but you still can sit back and go, not till two.
Not till two.
I'm not going in there. Free man.
Kenya might be a cool spot for a wedding. at a Maasai wedding in Kenya, it's not uncommon to see the bride's father bless his daughter by spitting on her head and breasts before she leaves the village with her new husband. You know, so proud of you, honey.
Yeah. Nothing tells me just one dude did it and everybody laughed and like, yeah, that's tradition now. I don't see the, you know, the religious or, you know, heartwarming story behind spitting on your daughter and your interface and in her chest. I mean, there's the exclamation point.
Well, Sweden's a cool place. Sweden's probably a beautiful
Absolutely.
Place to visit.
Isn't
so,
that where Steven Seagal's are at?
Finland. Next
My
door.
Apology.
So whether either the bride or groom leaves their table to use the bathroom, the other gets kissed a lot. If the groom has to go, then every male in the reception will get a chance to kiss the bride. So if you leave your bride basically unattended,
yeah.
all your hornball friends just come and basically molest your wife and kiss her. And then the
I
same
just
thing.
Imagine the bachelor party where some creep friend of yours gives you like buffalo wings or something like that to make you get the runs at some point. And tomorrow's my day.
Rubbing his hands together all
the time. Yes. Yes. Eat the spicy wings. Yes. That sounds like a very odd but funny movie.
Yeah, like some American Pie type movie. You know, like, we got him. Stifler. In the days of Sparta, Spartan culture, women would have to shave their heads and dress up like men before waiting to get stolen away by their groom-to-be. So they got to get all butched up.
Kind of the opposite of what women do here.
Right, right. Sparta was a tough...
So...
time
I mean it's tough enough for some guys to tie the knot, then add to it when they walk down the aisle you see some butch thing coming at you and you're like so that's my lifetime, huh?
Yeah France lover, you know, very the land of love and yes. romance. After the wedding ceremony is complete, the friends of the bride and groom would collect all of the leftovers, bits of trash, and anything else they deemed to be sufficiently gross within a toilet bowl, which they would then force the bride and groom to drink out of. Although these days the trash is often substituted with chocolate, you're still drinking brown stuff out of a real live toilet bowl. Not that romantic.
No.
Come on, France.
How long did they go where it's just like, all right, enough, get the chocolate? I mean, you had to think there was a good, like, 100-year period where somebody just said, okay, this is my fifth marriage, stop it.
All right, Ireland, big fan of Ireland. When the bride and groom are dancing, the bride's feet have to stay on the floor. The Irish believe that if they don't, evil fairies will come and sweep her away. The logic, evil fairies like beautiful things. The bride is beautiful. The fairies can only get to her if she's not touching the ground.
See, that's the plot for Leprechaun 9. Like, there's this Irish wedding, and then the girl saw a mouse, and she jumps in the air, and then the leprechaun's like, I'll get you.
Or like A.J. Mattioli's new movie, like, hey. Sorry, different kind of fairies.
Mm.
Brian Anderson comes out.
This is very weird, this country. I came here for Guinness. What the hell?
All right. One of the stranger wedding traditions comes to us from the Irish counties of Leitrim and Mayo. In these counties, there are 9 young men that are collectively designated as straw boys. On the eve before the wedding, the straw boys go to the house of the bride and dance with her. If there are any other women in the home, they dance with them, too.
This just sounds like a stripper-gram. I don't know. Hey, we're the straw boys.
We're the straw boy. Of course, they're probably all jacked.
Yeah.
Like, really hot.
Oh, you have friends here. You know what we gotta do. We're the straw boys.
The straw boys. All right. In Uyghur culture, an ethnic Chinese minority, the groom will actually shoot his bride with a bow and arrow before the wedding 3 times. The arrows don't have arrowheads, but still they like getting shot with they're like getting shot with rubber bullets. Once the deed is done, the groom will collect the arrows and break them, thus ensuring they will love each other forever.
How many times you think somebody said, oops, wrong arrows?
Shoot your wife 3 times?
Don't worry, babe. There's only 2 more left. And then tomorrow will be together forever.
On the Mauritius Islands of French Polynesia, after the wedding reception is over, the relatives of the bride all lay side by side in the dirt, face down. the bride and groom then walk across them like a human rug.
See, I'm kind of down with that.
All right.
I would totally be down with that at my wedding.
I'm going to invite you to your wedding. If you want to be my human rug to test it out, I'll gladly walk on to mine.
As long as we're even, that's all that matters.
I'll walk right on top of it.
Afterwards, it's like, oh, my tux is dirty. Then I can get in some regular clothes and really be relaxed.
Oh.
Unless your mom is there, in which case she might yell at me.
That's true. That's true. You got to go back for that story.
No, no. Put on those dirty pants. I don't care. Those don't match your
shoe thieves, which I'm actually excited about. My buddy Taryn's getting married. It's an Indian culture where the groom is required to take off his shoes before approaching the altar. As soon as he does, mayhem ensues. Everyone from the bride's side of the family tries to steal them, while everyone from the groom's side of the family tries to protect them. If the bride's family succeeds in their endeavor, they're allowed to hold the shoes hostage until they get paid a ransom.
Oh my God.
I'm protecting those shoes at all costs. My luck, I'm like elbow his mom in the face, ruin the wedding.
Somebody pulls out a gun. All right.
Okay.
Shoes are mine. Get back.
Let's see. No country in the world officially recognizes human-animal marriages as practiced in many countries like India to ward off the bad spirits.
Just give us some time.
Some villages in Africa require an older woman to accompany the newlyweds into their bedroom on the first night of their marriage in order to show the bride the ropes. Although they usually a village elder, sometimes it could be the bride's own mother.
Huh. Show the ropes. It's like, come here, son-in-law.
Yeah.
Now, honey, this is how you stretch beforehand. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now, he might like this, so, just stretch out beforehand.
In the Congo, in order for the marriage to be taken seriously, the bride and groom are not allowed to smile throughout the entire ceremony.
Well, that sounds like your first marriage. Nah.
That is so accurate. Mm. kidnapping the bride, Mike, you'd like this one. practiced in many countries throughout Africa and Asia, it can lead into women being raped and forced into marriage, especially in nations like Rwanda.
I'm the straw.
The kidnap.
We gotta get t-shirts. Verbal Shenanigans. I'm the straw boy.
Listening to them straw boys. In France, friends and family of the newlyweds congregate outside of the newlyweds' home on the first night of the marriage while proceeding to bang on pots and pans, yell, and just in general be as annoying as possible. Not only would this complicate the whole let's be romantic thing, the newlyweds are also required to go outside and appease them for snacks and drinks.
So you're banging pans on my lawn, and I had to go out there and give you a fruit roll-up?
Yep. Korea.
What?
Friends of the groom remove... once the wedding is over, friends of the groom remove his socks, tie a rope around his ankles, and start beating his feet with fish in order to prepare him for his first night as a married man.
Oh, yeah.
So imagine that, Mike, the night's ending, I'm saying bye to everyone, and then not so fast. You have a big herring to smack my feet around.
Still sounds kind of awesome. I got to be honest and all. If I got a couple drinks in me, I'd be like, all right, go ahead.
Feel free to bring a trout. Go ahead. All right, this is my last and favorite one. Fat farms. Beauty is relative, and there's nothing in the world that exposes that more than the country of Mauritania. Evidently, there's a huge difference between a fat camp and a fat farm. We Westerners go to fat camps to get skinny. Mauritanian girls go to fat farms to get fat and eventually married.
So they literally bulk up. So, like, the hottest show in some countries is My 600-Pound Life.
My 600-Pound Bride, baby.
Mm, yeah.
That's combining, like, everything on TLC.
And we got a marathon for you.
Yeah, so, girls aged between 5 and 15 are sent to fat farms before their wedding to pile on the pounds. If a bride has stomach rolls, stretch marks, and overlapping thighs, it signaled her husband was wealthy enough to keep her satisfied.
Good for you, other countries. That's all I have to say.
I think I'm going to stay here in America.
Yeah, we're just going to stick with the straw boys and smacking people with fish.
All right, let's get to a guest.
All right.
I know it's time to get to a guest.
I agree.
All right, Mike, we got two guests tonight. Are you a fan of, like, animated movies?
Very much so. Go to a lot of them. I mean, the girl loves them. A lot of them now, even though they say they're kids' movies, you can tell by the plots. They kind of push more towards like an adults and making more tear jerkers, and they're really thought out well. So it's not like the old days where it's like a hippopotamus comes around and farts, and it's like.
It sounds like a great movie.
Oh, don't steal it.
When's that coming out?
Mike, I have a project for you when you're done with this podcast.
So you're a fan of Pixar movies, right?
Very much so.
Yeah, I like them. I don't see all of them anymore, but I remember having like a lot that I really enjoyed. So what's like your favorite of all time?
Of all Pixar's?
Yeah, Pixar. Or like a couple. Like
Wreck-It Ralph. That was a really good one.
I feel like you and Wreck-It Ralph were probably like soul brothers.
Soul brothers?
Yeah, like Like I don't know. I feel like you could be Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah, probably.
Just smashing things. And like,
yeah, well, he didn't want to be the bad guy. Everybody made him the bad guy. He didn't want to be the bad guy. That was the point of the story. Or were you going to respond to that?
You got a little emotional with Ralph. See? You're connecting with him.
Oh.
That's the point of the story.
Why can't you listen to me, Scott? I'm not the bad guy of the shenanigans. But, I mean, all the Toy Story movies, obviously.
Yeah, Toy Stories are my favorite.
Up was amazing.
Up was good.
I just saw that a couple nights ago.
The Incredibles is good.
I just saw that recently.
No. So you're catching up.
Yep.
Finding Nemo was great, the first one. So it's amazing that, like, Toy Story has now been, like, an institution for 20 years, basically.
It's been that long.
But it's very interesting to think that, like, I remember when that technology, like, came out, that, like, 3D animated technology is, like...
At first, they were, like, boxes when people were trying to play around with it. They weren't looking like... cartoons for like
right term. And I remember like Toy Story just being that first one that whoa, like how did they do that, you know, like and now it's funny because you don't see any of the old school like animated movies. They're all that 3D animation. Like you don't see any like the 2D like drawn like Looney Tunes kind of movies really at all anymore.
Yeah, I can't trying to think. I probably like the only one that comes to mind is a South Park movie. That's about it.
Right, right. But I mean, for like kids, like capturing their imagination. So everything now, like Moana and there's a new one, Coco.
Coco. I didn't see that. Inside Out.
Inside Out. All these movies. And they just seem to keep capturing kids' imaginations and Frozen. Like,
Monsters, Inc.
Yeah, there's always like, you know, there's always that one that just hits and it's like the next big thing for like 3 years. So without further ado, But I want to bring we have been fighting scheduling battles, my mistake, and then cancellations, and then things came up. But I'm very happy to bring on from Pixar Animation Studios, animator himself, Mike Stern. Mike Stern's worked on Cars 3 and Coco and Finding Dory and The Good Dinosaur and Inside Out, How to Train Your Dragon, The Croods, Rise of the Guardians, B-movies.
Basically, if you brought your kid to it and you cried like a baby in the middle of the movie theater, he probably painted something in
it. Right, or just Mike.
Nah, yeah, that's just me in any movie.
Just you crying in the theater.
I always get sad at Police Academy 4.
But I'm very excited to talk to him. It's a world I've, like, you hear about a lot, but you don't.
I feel like the full story.
The FBI, like it's closed in. Like you don't get it, and I probably still won't get it after the interview. But without further ado, here's Mike Stern. First off, thank you guys for that was my faux pas last week. So I didn't put two and two together and think that Pixar is on the West Coast. Thanks for finally joining us. I'm Scott, and this is my cohort here, Mike Berlew.
Evening, everyone.
Evening.
So you guys, so I guess you just got out of a production meeting at Pixar. Now, let me ask you, Mike, I'm going to ask you right off the bat. When you think of animating and graphic design, and like even from when a kid, I remember like all my art friends, like Pixar was the the mecca of jobs, the one that they were like, oh my God, this is what we're going for, this is what they want to be. Was that a thing for you going in, or did you just happen to find Pixar? How did you get involved in Pixar?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as Pixar was around, it was on the radar, but I may be older than you because Toy Story came out when I was in high school, so it was already,
okay.
You know, when I was a kid, it was Disney was making the animated movies, and of course, I was into Star Wars, too, so ILM seemed like a cool thing, but I was very much always into that type of thing, you know. I was always the kid in class that would draw. I think almost every artist here was that kid in their school. So It was always on the radar. And as soon as Pixar did come onto the map, like I knew that was something cool and something I wanted to be involved in.
Now, let me ask you, we were just talking right before you guys got on, right before you came on, and Toy Story was just the game changer, the mind blower, oh my God, like things can look like that, and the characters can look like the actors, and the story was well told, and it still holds up today. Did that movie have an effect on you, or was it something else that got you into animating?
Well, it's a lot of things, and I think it's actually a couple of things for me, because as much as I love drawing, and still love drawing, I can't draw at the level of that the Disney animators would draw it, and that, you know, even a lot of my fellow animators here can draw it. It was a combination of drawing and computers that actually, I think, even enabled me to consider this as a field. And a couple of movies that came out around that time, I think Terminator 2 was a couple of years before that, and I remember seeing like what they did with the effects in that movie and just being blown away. I remember Jurassic Park was a big one. And
right.
At the time, you know, how are they doing all this stuff that we're seeing on the screen? And then you find out it's computers. And I kind of had a knack for computers as well. So I think it was having a combination of an interest in drawing and art, and also an interest in computers, that kind of created the perfect set of circumstances to get into this kind of work.
Well, when you were starting out with your art, were you making your own art? Were you just replicating like different pictures or whatever? What were you just basically doing when you were going through like your schooling and all that?
I mean, I guess a lot of it was, just kind of like, you know, drawing pictures for like kids in class. I know when The Simpsons came out, I was doing a lot of drawings of that. Like whatever was popular in culture at the time, I was drawing. And I think I started getting into like comic book illustration around like the 90s when like that big comic book boom happened. And from there, it's like, I remember, there was always concerns like, okay, well, how do I make a career at this? And that was a concern for me. It was a concern for my parents. And I'm from New York originally. I'm on the East Coast as well. Right. And what you hear in New York is like, if you want to make money doing art, if you want to make a career doing art, you have to get into advertising. And I kind of followed that path. Actually, my career at Pixar is a second career for me. I worked in advertising before I got into animation. And I think part of that just has to do with when you're learning this stuff and you're interested in it, it all seems so far away and everything's kind of happening out in California. And as growing up out east, I didn't even know how to even go about getting into that line of work. So I actually went to school and I studied illustration, but eventually got into advertising design. And my first career was working as an art director in the advertising industry. I worked for J. Walter Thompson, which is one of the oldest advertising companies in existence. And it was my work at JWT, I started being involved with more work that involved animation. Kind of made the jump back to me saying, well, you know, now that the tools are on your desktop, you could do this stuff, you could learn this stuff on your own. It kind of piqued my interest back in animation. So I was interested in animation, made myself a professional by getting into advertising. And then I used the tools I was using as a professional in advertising led me back into animation.
Now, you get into you get called to come work on a film like B-Movie, and you did various other things. When you start off in the animation field on such a big motion picture, now this has always been a curiosity for me, like with teams of animators and things like that. It's like a foreign world for me. When you start, like, are you given like the lowest job on the totem pole? Like, are you just animating like a pencil on a desk or a tree in the background for hours? How does that work? Like, how does that work with like, is it just teams? Like, okay, you got background, you have foreground, you have the character. How does that work? Especially early on.
I mean, there's a crowds department, and I think most folks coming into the industry do work in the crowds department. And you're right, the crowds handles everything that's not a hero character in a scene. So anything in the background, anything on the sides, and eventually, you know, from doing successful work in the crowds department, you get promoted into an animation position. So yeah, when I came on, Bee Movie was the first thing I worked on at DreamWorks. Mm-hmm. I was hired at DreamWorks for 7 years before I worked at Pixar. Mm-hmm. And my first task there was doing crowd animation. So the cool thing about that is like you're doing animation in cycles. So you're creating a lot of footage of animation of characters doing various different things. And there's actually a software team that'll take that animation that you're building and plug it into the shots. So it's kind of like a technical job, an animation technical job.
Now when they give you an assignment, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just continue that for a second. I think a big misconception about being an animator in feature film is that a lot of times anybody that has any hand in the production side of the project is considered an animator. You know, I constantly see these articles coming out say, you know, Pixar animator, and an article could be about, you know, any kind of artist on the film. But the job of animator on a film is very specifically moving the digital model of the character in a scene. So by the time a shot comes to me, you know, the character's been modeled already, the character already has texture, the set has been built. It comes to me fully assembled in a shot, and my job is to create the performance of that character. So that's technically that's the modern job of a computer animator.
Interesting. So when they give you this job, do they give you specifically how they want them? Like you're talking about the character move. Do you have free range, like to say, I can see this character hopping around or something like that? Or do they have a very specific script? This is how they move and what they want to move.
So the for the crowds character stuff, that is like kind of it's broken down by moveset. So yeah, in that case, we'd say, okay, you know, we need a bunch of people, you know, just sitting in a room looking one direction, then looking the other, and you actually label them as that. You know, man looks left, woman looks left, man looks right. When it comes to actual shot animating, the way that's handled is that you're basically the department is handed a full sequence of shots, and every time the camera cuts, it's a single shot. And then it comes into the department, and the animation supervisors will divide those set of shots and cast them to the animators. So they look at the work that you've done before, maybe kind of take into consideration what kind of stuff you're interested in doing, and they'll break up that sequence into a series of shots and cast it to the animators. And then you have a kickoff with the director of the film. So you sit down in a room, and you're watching this sequence either in storyboard or in rough animatic form, and the director will go through each series of shots and kind of kick off the animator on what they're looking to get out of those shots. You know, maybe it's a specific acting beat they're looking for. Maybe it's just a rough emotion they're looking for. And it's the animator's job to interpret that kickoff and use that to build their ideas off of. So it's part of the job as an animator is knowing how much leeway you have within a shot. You know, sometimes it is, okay, well, the character's got to look from left to right. Let's make sure the shot does that. But sometimes it's a little bit more wiggle room. So I think, okay, maybe there's a spot to layer in some entertainment in the shot. Maybe there's a chance to kind of even break away what was being done in the storyboards and, you know, make this shot a little bit more interesting for the purposes of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, just hearing that, like, just hearing you talk, like, as a person who has no idea about animation and work, it just generates question after question after question. But I guess what I want to ask you is, the first thing I was thinking of is like, say, okay, I got a film, whatever, Disney or Pixar has a film, or DreamWorks has a film. Okay, this is going to be an hour and a half film. It's coming out this long. Like, it's coming out this year. How long does it take to make like a feature film? And I'm sure I want to get into technology change in a minute, but back in 2006 as opposed to now, how long are those projects? Like, and do they put you on one thing? Like, okay, this is what you're working on for the next 2 years, or are you dabbling in this film, dabbling in that film? Like, how does that work?
It kind of works differently in different cases. Like, at this point, you know, we have had some animators. Well, you know, both here and when I was at DreamWorks, we've had animators that'll go on to one film for a little bit, then go on to a different film. But ideally, you know, you want to have your crew, when they ramp onto the film, they're on it, and they stay on it until the film is done. Within the animation department, I think most CG films are in animation for, you know, just over a year, maybe a year and a half. Before that, they're in development, they're in story, they're in you know, production art and asset building for years before that. But in most cases, I think the longest I've ever worked on a film was, you know, a year and a couple months, so maybe like 14 months or so. But yeah, so, and as for the individual animator, if you're coming on as, you know, one of the pre-pro animators, pre-production, you're grabbing the models, you're testing stuff out, you're making sure that the characters are properly set up and articulated for the rest of the animators that are going to come on to the show. So in that case, you'd be on the show early and, you know, be kind of getting stuff ready for the rest of the crew that's going to roll on. For the average production animator, you know, you come on a little bit later and you dive right into shot work, and you stay on the film until the shot work is completed.
So when you get these scripts, is it pretty much a set script from that point on? Is there a lot of times where it's like, oh, there was a rewrite and you have to go back and do animation for that? Or is it pretty much everything is said and done when you get a project?
Oh, no. No, I mean, that's kind of like the blessing and the curse of being a computer animated film. You know, with live action, you can be more spontaneous when you're shooting. But at the end of the day, it's like what you have on camera, that's it. You got to cut that. Whereas with an animated film, it's like you can create anything. Any shot, you can see anything you want in it. I think with that freedom, sometimes it's like, you know, we're right up to the edge of that deadline, you know, still working on this thing until it's about to come out. And that happens a number of times. You know, we wrap animation just a couple of months before, you know, the movie's ready to hit the theaters.
Now, how close do you guys work with, okay, I cast Mike, my buddy here, as a character, and they got cast in the movie beforehand. And like, I still think one of the coolest things is always like, oh, that guy's the voice, and seeing somehow like how you incorporate their personalities or even their look. Like, how closely do you work with that? I know there's like mocap and stuff like that. Like, does that happen? Or like, I just always think of like how Woody and Buzz look like, you know, Tim Allen and Tom Hanks. How close do you guys work with that or know that? And have you ever had an experience where maybe an actor changed or something changed along the way where you had to go back and reanimate like almost a whole, all your work?
There are times where there's changes made to the story that cause us to go and reanimate some of the work. As far as working with the actors and actresses, we do get a recorded video of the voice session that they do. So basically when they're in the recording studio, mm-hmm. you know, looking at the lines and, you know, making the audio recording, they actually record the actor's expressions as well. And I'll look to that once in a while. I don't use it as a sole source of inspiration or reference for the animation I'm going to do, but sometimes it's helpful to see just, you know, how their mouth moves a certain way when they say certain words, or sometimes, you know, maybe it's a nod in the head. Maybe it's just something small that I could pick up from them seeing them perform the line. And I'll especially do that if there's something that's not working about my shot, especially in the dialogue. Like if there's something in the dialogue that it seems like the mouth isn't convincingly saying the dialogue in my shot, a lot of times I'll go and look at that reference to see, you know, what exactly that shape of the mouth is doing when that sound was created.
Now, along with your animation career, I've seen you also have done some writing and directing for an animation short, Distraction. Tell us a little bit about that. Yeah. What made you want to create that project?
Well, the thing is, that was a short film I created in animation school. So, you know, I took after my career in advertising, I went back to school, to animation school, first in NYU in New York, did a continuing education course there, and that's where I learned like the basics of 3D software. And then there's an online school that was opened up actually by some Pixar animators and some ILM animators called Animation Mentor, and they had an online course you could take to learn animation. And so at the time, they had the final course was to create a short film using their characters. So that project was just, it started off as just a way for me to learn 3D animation and to make it, you know, to actually learn how to make a film. And so in doing that, I did the majority of it while I was taking the course. I think over the course of, let's say, 24 weeks was how long the course was. And I got it about 75% of the way there. And then after that, I was actually hired at DreamWorks as an animator before the short was finished. So while I was at DreamWorks, I was coming home at night and still working on that film. And I got some help from some friends to help light and do the rendering on it. And even went in and I had to record the music track because the track I was using was copyrighted. So I had to go in and record something similar to the track I was using, but, you know, different enough so that there, you know, wouldn't be any infringement on the artist. And so, but when I finished that short, the cool thing about it was, and I submitted it to a bunch of festivals, and I realized that, you know, a short like that can open more doors than any kind of animation reel can. You know, generally the process for finding a job in animation is you put together a reel of what you consider your best shots, you know, and it could be some mechanic shots or acting shots. Sometimes what you do, actually most of the time what you do is you grab a line from the movie and you slug it into your 3D animation program. You animate for that line from the movie. But having a short film, and I had it play in festivals. I met a bunch of other filmmakers and animators and directors. And it got me all these cool meetings with, you know, people who I never would have met with. And just the things that short film had done for me were something that animation reel never could. So it was such a good experience making that film and kind of taking the trip to all different festivals to play it.
That's awesome. Now I wanted to ask you. So you started on major scale with the B movie and worked on things from Cars 3 to Finding Dory to How to Train Your Dragon, all these big movies and whatnot. How has technology changed from just that time when you started to now? And has it made, like, I remember, like, just watching, like, the behind the scenes, like, animation things and, like, things rendering and taking forever. And, like, are you able to now, like, I was wondering, like, when you make sequels and stuff like that, like Cars, when are you able to, like, take these characters out of a and if I sound stupid, I'm sorry, but take them out of, like, a database and, like, okay, like, pull them into anime. Okay, now we have that character and now we're creating again. Like, is that how that works? Like, I just want to know the difference you've seen.
That's way too technical. You know, the funny thing is, like, I get, like, a lot of technical questions, like, you know, what kind of computer do you guys use? And, you know, I was like, I don't even know. Like, so much of my day, I'm just, like, totally focused on, like, the creative side of things that, like, I couldn't tell you how many processors are in the computer I'm using. I mean, the technology as far as the software has improved, but I keep waiting to be able to move and do this stuff faster. That's always the problem, is, like, you know, with fast tools and faster technology, we'll be able to make this stuff faster. But at the end of the day, you're still problem solving. You're still trying to figure out how this character is going to behave under these circumstances. And right. No kind of technology is going to help solve that problem for you. So, yeah, I mean, the tool, and I can definitely say, since I started, the tools have gotten a lot faster. I mean, the big thing with animation is just, you know, your recording time. Like, when you're mm-hmm. animating a scene, and the computer needs to draw it every frame and then right. play it back at speed so you could see it. And when I first got into this industry, you know, the processes were so much slower. So you hit record on your scene and you can go, like, take a water break and come back and then, you know, see what your animation looks like. And now it's almost instantaneous. They can move stuff around and then hit play and it's almost playing at real speed almost immediately, if not, you know, with a couple seconds away. So that's been huge, you know, being able to get that instant feedback. But the thing that I found is that the faster the technology gets, it's not like we're moving any faster because we keep trying to do more difficult and complex things. You know, right. It's like you look at a movie like Coco and you're adding new skeletons that have, like, all these different moving parts, you know, and that probably wouldn't have even been possible back, you know, in the early 2000s when this whole thing started. So yeah, the harder that, the more they push technology and the faster things get, the more we try to accomplish with every movie we get. So it's almost like evens itself out. Like, things go a little bit faster, we'll push harder and try to do more complex things. And I think you'll see that, like, even just comparing, like, the, you know, the new Incredibles trailer, right. the Incredibles 2 trailer that came out, compare that to, you know, the first Incredibles movie, and you can kind of see it on the screen, like, the complexities that are added into these, you know, new versions of the characters.
Now, I see you've done a sequel before, and with How to Train a Dragon 2, does it make it easier since it's a sequel with all the drawings that you did previously, or is it just another project, or you got to start from scratch, or do you just prefer a new project in the long run?
I don't know. In a lot of ways, I think sequels are more challenging because the great thing about How to Train Your Dragon, the first one I worked on, is that it was kind of like this little gem for us, because nobody, that's when I was at DreamWorks, How to Train Your Dragon. So we were working on this thing and we all thought it was really cool. And, you know, nobody had any kind of expectation for it because, you know, it was kind of, it was a children's book before it was a film, but there wasn't any kind of expectation for the movie. And, you know, when that movie started to take shape, like we really thought we were onto something, and that was the fun part of it. And then going on to the second one, it's almost like now that the first one's out, there's an expectation. And, you know, you got to make sure that what you're delivering is, you know, you're unconsciously telling yourself every day, like, oh, man, this has got to surpass the expectation that people have for it based on the first one. And that's the same thing, you know, with Finding Dory as well. Like, you know, as you're making a movie and you're watching the screen, you're like, man, this has got to meet people's expectations. And, you know, expectations are so high.
Yeah, I mean,
I missed part of the question, too. Like, you were talking about reusing assets and things like that. But to be honest with you, we don't really reuse assets too often. Like, when we went from Dragon 1 to Dragon 2 at DreamWorks, almost everything was built from scratch. Actually, I think everything was indeed built from scratch for the second one. Especially the models, they're different. I mean, you could say that you learn the characters on the first one, so you kind of have an idea of what the character's behavior is like, and you can identify them a little bit more. So you do have that advantage, but as far as a technical perspective, like actually reusing assets, like that very rarely happens.
Now, what is the average? I mean, you go back and you picture like the old Disney animators drawing. What does the average work day look like at Pixar? I mean, is it a bunch of animators in front of computers scrambling and typing into things, and you know, like a mad hustle, or is it like one guy doing the work and a lot of people collaborating? Like, give us like a little insight into like your average day. Like, what goes on?
Sure. I mean, it's different depending on the show, and it's also different depending on where you're at in your career. I remember when I first started out, like, you know, my schedule wasn't as regulated as it is now. You know, I got a family at home, and so I try to be as effective as I can in the hours that I'm here.
Right.
Whereas I think back in the day, maybe I tend to goof off a little bit more and then, you know, work later nights and kind of have a little bit more of an unstructured schedule. But when I'm at my best and things are working for me, I'm, you know, at work on time for dailies at 9. At 9 o'clock on most shows, we get together in a room and we'll look at the latest animation that folks have created for the day. And we'll get up on screen. The director will give feedback. Hopefully there's some discussion in the room about, you know, what can be plussed. If there's something, you know, we're noticing in the shot that we think might help benefit other animators, we'll talk about that and make sure that those notes get around to the crew and that we're doing that stuff in a consistent way. Dailies usually wrap around 10. At that point, I'll get some desk time. I'll try to be working pretty consistently at my desk, animating on the computer from about 10 to around noon. So I get 2 hours in the morning. At noon, I like to do some kind of exercise, hopefully outside if I can, but there's also a gym here. If I can get to do that, that's, you know, that's the move there. I found, like, that's an hour well spent. If I can get out and go to do some exercises, like, it helps the second part of my day. And so then after the gym, I'll do a quick lunch and then get back to work. So hopefully by 4 o'clock, I'll start by 4 o'clock, like at 2 o'clock, hopefully I'm back at my desk again and I can get another couple hours in of intense animation. If I'm trying to show for walkthroughs at night, sometimes I'll try to power through and do a strong afternoon right into walkthroughs, which are usually around like 4:30 or 5. If not, I'll usually take a break in the middle of that, like maybe around 4:30 again, try to get outside and move around a little bit, maybe talk to some people, see what's going on. And there's various things going on here during the day, like meetings or educational things that have going on. So I'll try to partake in that stuff as well. And I usually try to wrap around. I'll start winding down around 6:30, and hopefully, if I'm on a good schedule, I'm out of here by 7 and ready to do it again the next day. As things get crazier, you know, sometimes that number, an hour just a little bit later, and when things are in crunch, you know, sometimes we'll come in on Saturdays. But that's typically, you know, my schedule. And the collaboration happens, you know, when you're in the room at dailies. There's also times where, like, I'll stop with other animators in the hall and just have them come in, take a look at what I'm doing. Other animators will come ask me to take a look at their work. Like that's where the collaboration happens. But it is a lot of hours sitting down in front of your computer figuring this stuff out. And I guess maybe that's like another misconception people have about animation, especially when you see in the behind the scenes, there's a lot of, you know, they tend to capture the culture of the studio, which is great. You know, a lot of socializing and people riding around on scooters. But for to do this job for a living, it does require a lot of hours spent in front of the computer, intensely involved in your animation.
Now, when the film comes out, are you able to watch the film and appreciate everything? Or are you looking at the film, maybe looking at some of the background? Ooh, that I put that building on the wrong side. No, that doesn't look right.
Yeah, are you able to enjoy it?
Yes and no. I mean, the way it works as an animator, you know, I told you how we break this stuff into shots.
Right.
The way a movie plays for me when I see it in that rap screen, the first time I'm seeing it is like, the movie stops for a second. Here's this thing that I obsessed over for, you know, however long it was on, a couple of weeks, a month even, and then the movie starts again. And yeah, the first time you see it, all you can see are those things that, oh, I wish I pushed that more, or, oh, that could have been clearer, that could have been funnier. Like, of course, you're just constantly seeing the stuff you could have improved. And then what happens is, over the years, or, you know, sometimes it happens a couple of months, sometimes it takes years just to happen, but you forgive yourself for it. And now, like, if I watch those movies with my kids, I don't think about all the stuff that, you know, drove me crazy the first time I saw it. I just see it as a movie, and, you know, I can enjoy it how it is. And I do love seeing the movies with an audience, especially the opening weekend, because sometimes the way a movie plays to you as a crew, right, it plays totally different to an audience, and you don't even realize it. So I do really like that experience, and that way I can appreciate it.
Well, it's funny. You touched on two things I wanted to ask you. One is when having kids, do they think it's like the coolest thing ever? Their dad makes these kid movies. Well, you know, for movies for everyone, but generally these amazing kid movies. Or are they like, yeah, whatever, dad, like, stop talking. And two, are you able to sit back and pick out like a movie that you've worked on that's my piece, that is like my favorite, like I still see it and I call my, or is it just like each movie you work on, you're just building more and more skills and you're proud of all of them?
That's a two good question. As far as a kid, they love it. I mean, they think it's so great. Like, you gotta get, we went to Disneyland recently with my daughter, and like, and she was telling like everybody that we met that I worked on Coco and how excited she was about it. It was actually, you know, to the point where it gets kind of embarrassing. Because you actually use like your Pixar pass at Disneyland to get in and get a discount on things. And so she, as soon as like you show your pass, like, oh, so where do you work in the park? And I say, oh, I work at Pixar. And then everyone would chime in and just immediately start talking about, you know, what I did. And what was really cool on Coco was that for a lot of our animation, what we do to get ideas is we'll use a camera and we shoot ourselves. Like, so for acting, usually to get the imagination going, I'll turn on a camera, I'll record myself doing a couple of things just to see what might fit in the shot. Huh. And so for this one on Coco, I actually involved my daughter in that process.
That's awesome.
So I used to use a camera and I'd explain to her, okay, here's what I need to do by this shot, and here's what you need to do to help me act it out. And I got her involved, and she just loved that. And then when a couple weeks later, when I had animated the shot, I brought her in to look at the reference and look at the shot together.
Wow,
and
she tremendous.
Thought it was the coolest. Yeah, she thought it was like the coolest thing ever.
Wow.
And then the second part of the question was, as far as, you know, do you have a favorite? And the answer is no. It's like, they're kind of like your kids. It's like,
right,
each movie kind of, right, represents a different experience to you. And it's not just, each movie, it kind of means something different to you. There's a movie that was released in the theater, and then there was the production. There was the act of working on it. And I think I mentioned this in one of our animation talks the other day. Like, animating a shot can be a lot like, you know, it's a lot like shooting a basketball. It's like you can shoot a basketball and it can go like perfectly through the hoop, nothing but net. Or you could shoot a basketball like one-handed. It kind of it hits off the top of the backboard and by a lucky chance just gets in. You know, both those baskets are worth 2 points. And, you know, I've had this experience with shots in both ways. But I have the shots that it just seems like everything comes naturally. Everything comes easily. I get the shot and you know what to do with it. I'm right in there, I'm animating it. And, you know, first showing, it's final. And then I have the shots where no matter what I do, I cannot figure out how to crack it. You know, I've animated it three different times, three different ways, and it just does not seem to be going well. Mm-hmm. And then there's everything in between. And that's part of, like, the mentality of being an animator is, like, you got to be willing to get back on the horse time and time again, because there's going to be, you know, there's those shows that are great where it's easy, and there's those shows where there's a challenge where everything just seems hard, everything just seems difficult. And then there's the ones in between, and sometimes those stretches can go on for really long periods of time. And I've had long periods in my career where I felt like I was really on top of things and really, you know, really killing it. And then I have times in my career where I feel like I'm a fraud and they're going to kick me out of this building at any point, you know, and you got to be willing to, like, even though you're having that feeling, to still come in and do it every day and try to troubleshoot, you know, what's not working and make it better. And I think every artist here deals with that.
Now, with Pixar being a part of Disney, now Pixar has made some great movies, and before that, when you were in DreamWorks, some iconic characters. But as you're working for a division of Disney right now, would you love to try to tackle some of their iconic characters and bring them on screen? Because I can't even remember the last time, like, even like Mickey Mouse was in like a major film, or any of the other, like, Snow White's or anybody like that.
I mean, the folks at Disney just did that. I mean, yeah, Pixar is owned by Disney, but they're two separate studios, and Disney actually has a feature animation studio down in Burbank that probably handles most of those things. But that being said, I mean, I feel like, you know, Buzz and Woody are iconic characters, and I've been doing this for a while now, and the thing is, like, the more you do that, like, the longer you've been in this career, the more, like, not to say that it feels like a job, but you're a professional, right? It's like you do it for a living, and sometimes, like, the magic can start to fade a little bit, but then there's those little moments that just kind of spark you up again. And I feel grateful every day to drive in here. I get to drive under that Pixar logo and park and go in. But I remember when I first started here, within my first year, I got to work on the Toy Story Christmas special they made, Toy Story The Times of God, and I got to open up a shot and to see the digital character of Buzz and Woody in there for me to animate. And that was like a real moment for me. It's like, wow, this is really special. Yeah, it's like, this is so cool. I get to animate these characters. And the same thing on Dory and in Incredibles. You know, Incredibles was the movie that, you know, really solidified my decision to do this for a living. I was working in advertising. I was trying to learn 3D animation on the side. And then I saw that film, like, man, it's like, I got to be part of this. Like, there's got to be a way I could figure out to do this for a living, to make these kind of movies. And so, yeah, you get those first shots in Incredibles, and you see Bob in there. It's like, wow, it's like I get to do this now. It's super exciting.
Well, Mike, you certainly have made a career. I mean, your resume is ridiculously impressive, and it's amazing to, like, I don't know, to separate, like, talking to you, this picture on my screen, and then also hearing you, like, how passionate you are about it and the experiences you have and all these movies we've seen. So I want to thank you for coming on. I could talk to you for hours, but if people want to check you out or see what you're currently working on or what you've done recently, where can they go, and what have you done recently that, like, is the most and the newest thing that people should watch?
Well, Coco was a movie that came out this year.
Yep.
So you should check that out. And I'm currently working on Incredibles 2, which comes out this summer. Yeah. Mm. So I'm excited about that. I had a website up for a bit, but it got dated, and I'm so crazy here. I didn't have time to update it. But I've got
It's funny to see the Pixar animator with, like, a angel flyer website.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, he's, like, really old, and I'm like, this isn't doing me any good. Like, for the guy. I think I have a Vimeo page up that might have some of my DreamWorks work on it. So if you go to Vimeo, my username, I think, is Sternio. So you find it there. So Sternio on Vimeo. And I have a Twitter handle that's Super Sternio. And I'm on Twitter once in a while. I'm not on it a ton, but I'll be on there every once in a while checking stuff out and, you know, posting stuff every now and then.
Mike, thank you so much for making this happen. I'm glad we were able to fight through our scheduling battles here.
Yeah.
And it was it really was great to talk to you, man. And I really appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So this is...
Huh. We just animated a music video all of a sudden.
I don't know what that was, but... Something from Spotify. I could talk to that guy all day.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
just so opposite of what I do or what you do or what any of my friends really do. I have one friend in, like, the animation world, but, like, it's just a job. Like, my brain doesn't, like... can't compartmentalize,
comprehend what goes into like a every project day, like
yeah
that.
I'm gonna go animate like Nemo's fin today, you know, like it's mind-blowing, and he seems like he's worked on like so many things. It's crazy.
It's an incredible list. Everybody should check out his IMDb with the list of the movies he's been a part of. I almost kind of wonder if he's one of them guys, he's just like, man, I just want to get back to the college championship football game. And it's like somebody, some 50-year-old stops him on the street and asks him 50 questions about Nemo.
Or he's on a podcast.
Tell us about Puss in Boots.
No, but just a really cool interview.
I did the boots.
Yeah. But, all right, Mike. You like chimpanzees, right?
Monkeys are cool.
Monkeys freak me out a little bit, not going to lie. They're just too smart. They're too smart. I like... a little bit dumber of an animal, like Obi. Like, I like Obi.
You want an animal that can not beat you at a shell game.
That's what I'm talking about. The monkey, I'm not entirely confident I would beat a chimpanzee in chess or checkers or even just general life trivia.
I smell a bit.
No. But you've heard of Jane Goodall, correct?
Of course.
The one and only Jane Goodall. But we don't have Jane Goodall coming on.
Uh-huh.
So let's not get... that crazy. But we do have someone that works directly with her from the Jane Goodall Foundation. And he goes by the name of Sean Sweeney. His name is Sean Sweeney. So we're going to give him a call and kind of learn all about what the Jane Goodall Foundation does these days. Mm-hmm. So let's get him on the line.
JGI, this is Sean.
Hey, Sean. This is Scott Brennan and Mike from Verbal Shenanigans. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
We're doing awesome, man.
Doing well, sir.
So where are we calling you from?
I am in Gilbert, Arizona, just outside of Phoenix.
Oh, all right. All right. We're in Jersey, so we're nowhere.
Oh, nice.
Nowhere near any chimpanzees or anything, but
we got a zoo somewhere.
Yeah. How are you faring in the cold?
Today was a nice balmy 30, so yeah. It was...
Oh,
it's going to go up
that's
to...
That's awesome.
Yeah, we're going to go up to 50 in a couple of days.
I think we're out of it, but the last like week was like 6s, 7s, so...
Yeah.
But it's all right. It's all right. So, Sean, what exactly do you do for the Jane Goodall Foundation? I saw like you've been there for quite a while now. So what do you do? What do you do and how do you get involved with that?
Yeah, so I've been around for 11 years now. I actually got involved in college when Jane came and visited my school, the College of Worcester, in Worcester, Ohio. I had been studying animal behavior there and really wanted to get into primatology. And Jane came to visit, to give a lecture, and I had the privilege of kind of being her student ambassador while she was on campus, and told her that I would quit school if she had a job for me, and she told me that was a silly idea, but you know, that I should finish my degree, but if I really wanted to help to join the Jane Goodall Institute's youth program, Roots and Shoots. So I decided to start a Roots and Shoots group in my college, and did that for a couple of years and just kind of stayed close to the Institute and, you know, volunteered in various things here and there, and eventually applied for our College Leadership Council. And got on to the council, and while I was on the council, there was a fellowship position that opened up at the Institute, and I applied for that, and that's kind of how I began, and that was back in 2007.
Right.
That I had my fellowship, and been on staff ever since.
That's awesome.
So,
now, for a guy studying primatology and just animal behavior and things like that, what is it like when you find out that, like, Jane Goodall, the woman we kind of associate with knowing, you know, anything about chimpanzees and apes, and we've heard about her in books and when we're kids, and like I said, in the classroom, we still talk about her all the time. What is it like to meet her and kind of, like you said, even like be able to just talk to her the first time?
Well, it's really funny because my dad is a retired science teacher. He taught high school science for 35 years. So, you know, Jane was among the, you know, people, you know, totally a household name for us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of grew up with her, with knowing, being aware of her work and being fascinated with primates and animals in general. So, for me, meeting her, I think it's, you know, a lot of people, and I've witnessed this over the last decade, you know, Jane is many people, especially young women and girls, which makes me very happy. You know, Jane is a hero to them. And, you know, she's definitely a hero to me. And I just, you know, that's why I offered to give up school for her if I could. You know, it's just, you can't find a better soul to meet. And I, you know, I've come over the years to appreciate that Jane is, you know, there's, and Jane even jokes about this now, that there's two Janes. You know, there's a sort of icon and hero Jane that we all read about in textbooks and, you know, see in her latest documentary that Nat Geo just put out this past fall. You know, there's that Jane, and then there's the sort of very personable, social, you know, humorous Jane that's very chill and down to earth and laid back. And it's just so neat to have been able to get to know both Janes and to see how, you know, she brings both of them along with her. And, you know, she can get up in front of a crowd of 60,000 people and, you know, be, you know, incredibly remarkable, and then go backstage and play a prank on someone. And it's, you know, it's just so neat to experience that.
So how many projects are going on in the Institute? Is it just focus on like one goal, or do you have many other projects with different animals and things with the environment?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So Jane has always wanted us to continue doing the long-term research at Gombe in Tanzania, where she did her research. So we continue that. And in just 2 years, we're going to be celebrating 60 years of that research. So it's pretty incredible. So, so you know, we're really excited about to continue doing that research and have the life histories of the chimps that we do. So we have that as one of our major efforts. But you know, Jane realized in the late 80s, early 90s that chimps are incredibly endangered. And a lot of that, a lot of the reasons why chimps are being endangered are driven by human threats. Mm-hmm. So the Jane Goodall Institute has established a number of different programs to address those threats, they being habitat destruction, the wildlife trafficking and bushmeat trade, and disease transmission. Chimps can actually get diseases from humans. That's how close we are.
Right.
So, but you know, one of the main drivers of all three of those threats is the really terrible poverty that we see in many countries across Africa, and certainly across the 21 countries where chimpanzees are native. So the Jane Goodall Institute has all of these programs to work on helping, work in partnership with communities to help change their socioeconomic status, to create new opportunities for them to make their livelihoods in sustainable and environmentally friendly ways that, you know, make it so that they don't have to take down the forest to build their farms or for firewood or things like that. And really just focusing on making sure that we can maintain as much habitat for chimpanzees as we can, and really create a nice buffer for the chimps from the human communities. And that buffer helps not only give them that habitat, but also helps protect them from disease transmission and gives them more space from other humans, so that it's harder to hunt them and capture them and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we have a big emphasis on working directly with communities to help, you know, raise their quality of living. And there's a really great emphasis in there on women and young girls, which I really love. You know, we know all you know, across, around the globe, there's been a lot of examples around how when we help ensure the well-being and engagement and involvement of women and helping young girls stay in school, that, you know, many things in the communities are improved. So really great through line there, from Jane being, you know, a pioneering female scientist to, you know, helping empower and enable women and young girls through our conservation work. And then along those same lines, around the world, we have our youth program, Roots and Shoots, which I mentioned previously. I was involved in Roots and Shoots when I was in college, and the program continues today. Jane started Roots and Shoots in 91 after, you know, really working with communities and encountering a lot of young people who told her that they felt like their future had been stolen from them. And, you know, there's really nothing they could do to prevent some of the problems that they were seeing in their communities and around the world. And, you know, this was back in the early 90s. Certainly they were, you know, facing many environmental challenges, but I think the visibility of those challenges has, you know, today become so much more apparent. And, you know, so very forward thinking back then to establish this program that helps empower young people to identify the problems that they care about the most in their communities, and then come up with projects themselves that address those problems. And, you know, they can be simple as recycling in the classroom to, you know, working with Kellogg's to take palm oil out of their products, or, you know, Girl Scouts and taking unsustainable palm oil out of their products. So
yeah,
wide variety of things they do.
I find it fascinating. You touched on kind of where I was thinking. I find it fascinating that what started with, you know, Jane observing chimpanzees and studying primates, and all you guys studying primates, to how it all links to, you know, poverty and empowering communities, and how they almost directly affect one another. It's very interesting to think that.
Yeah, it's incredible, and I can totally see how, you know, the Sustainable Development Goals from the United Nations are aligned with the kind of work that we've discovered through our experience over the last 40 years as an organization. You know, how they've come together in recognizing that the way that we treat the environment is directly tied to our world economy, the economy of our communities, you know, the ways that we're consuming, you know, in many ways unsustainably, our natural resources.
Now take us through an average day, like what you do for the organization. And like, did you start out in the, like, when you're studying primatology and wanting to get into that field, how do you eventually like get into observing chimps and primates, and how did that build to your career today? Like, what do you do?
That's a good question.
He's like, nothing. I don't do anything.
Surf the internet for 8 hours.
It's a little bit of a winding road for me.
Okay.
But in my experience, it's that way for everyone. Yes. So I don't think I'm so special that way. But I actually started out on our Roots and Shoots team. I worked on Roots and Shoots for about 6 years and was doing youth outreach and engagement, where I was helping, you know, grow our network of Roots and Shoots members around the U.S. primarily, and, you know, supporting our colleagues internationally who also are working to grow Roots and Shoots. And eventually I moved over to our community engagement team for the whole organization. And now, a typical day for me is really just working with my colleagues to understand what we're doing in the field and coming up with new exciting ways for people to get involved with us, to support our work, and, you know, really to talk about how their support is turning into impact on the ground in the places where we're working to protect chimps and engage young people, really.
Now, you just brought up working with people internationally. What's it like trying to work with different cultures and venues to try to get a common goal? Do you get a lot of pushback in certain scenarios, or is it mostly like friendly conversation with a common goal? We want to keep these animals alive.
Yeah, by and large, I mean, we're all driven by a mission, and we all can see different ways to accomplishing that mission. But in my experience, by and large, people are willing to hear each other out and, you know, see their way to whatever idea is being presented or a way to approach the work that we do. And, you know, I think that one of the things I've really experienced has been a real willingness to innovate and be open to new ideas and new approaches to how we approach conservation, especially using technology and new ways of thinking and that sort of thing. It's mm-hmm. I think everybody kind of sees the writing on the wall that time is running out, and, you know, we just got to check our egos at the door and do whatever we can to protect the habitat that we know the chimps need to survive.
Now, what is Jane up to these days? I know she's in her 80s,
yep.
Which is fascinating that she's been doing this since, you know, what, her 20s or earlier than that, if I remember correctly. But what is she up to these days? And is she still active? Is she still speaking or researching? What is she up to these days?
That's a great question. Jane's 83 now, and she started when she was 26. So she's been doing this for quite a long time. She is on a perpetual international tour doing lectures and supporting the Jane Goodall Institute, really, really growing a base of support in more than 24 countries around the world. And you know, even more than that, growing Roots and Shoots, which is in nearly 100 countries around the world. So, you know, that's really what she spends her time doing, speaking at different conferences, at universities, visiting schools, you know, elementary, middle school, high school, talking to kids and, you know, trying to get her message of hope out to people. She has a personal mission, you know, that we all share with her that, you know, without hope, we all might as well give up. And so, you know, she truly believes and, you know, we share in the belief that there is a lot that we can do. There's still a lot that's left worth fighting for. And, you know, as dismal as some people may paint the picture, we still have a lot that's left worth fighting for. So she's just on this perpetual tour helping to spread that message and help empower people. And she's a really, really amazing networker. You know, she sees potential for projects, you know, everywhere she goes. And I know recently she put a group of people together who were all doing swift conservation. Swifts are migratory birds, and you know, she somehow met swift people along the entire route of their migratory path and managed to put a bunch of them in contact with each other so they could coordinate and collaborate around their efforts to protect swifts. So, you know, just things like that are really what she's spending a lot of her time and energy on now.
Now, with this being an institution that's trying to help out primates and other animals, are there like standards in the institution that people have to hear by when they join it? Is there stuff like no leather? You have to be a vegetarian or anything somewhat like that?
That's an awesome question, too. And, you know, I would say we really just follow along with what we hear from Jane herself, in that she talks all the time about how every single day, every single one of us makes an impact on the planet. And it's up to us to decide whether or not we want that impact to be a positive one or otherwise. And, you know, to really pay attention to the little decisions that we make every day, you know, what we wear, what we buy, what we eat, and, you know, have a solid understanding of what kind of impact those decisions have on the planet and other people and the environment, and do what we can to change those decisions so that they are, you know, making the greatest impact and you know, making the greatest positive difference for people, animals, and the environment we can. So that's what I would say is the key there.
Now, I wanted to ask you something. I wanted to ask you, with all this conservation and all the work you guys doing, how have you noticed so you've been there 11 years. How have you noticed, like, the influence of technology? Not only just your networking virtually on email and whatnot, but like the use of technology, whether it's in these small villages or out in the field. How have you seen the impact of that? Whether, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of positive, but also negative too. Do you see a lot of good things coming with, you know, the advance of technology?
Yeah, we have seen a lot that's been amazing for science, conservation science, and the use of technology. The technology is being used now in our work at, you know, all levels, from having what we call forest monitors equipped with smartphones and tablets that they can use to go on patrols of the protected areas that we are establishing with them, and using that technology to monitor the forest and look out for trees that might be cut down or traps in the forest, or
text you know, your favorite chimp.
basically. And you know, the cool thing is there's even apps out now, like Global Forest Watch is a big partnership that's a bunch of NGOs that are working together to use satellite technology to monitor forests. And with the Global Forest Watch team, we developed an app called Forest Watcher that allows people to draw a polygon around an area of interest on a map. So, like, I live out here by Tonto National Forest, mm-hmm. and I have a thing set up where I draw a polygon around the area that's nearby me. And, you know, if there was some kind of deforestation that satellites picked up in the forest, I would get a notification on my phone.
Wow.
And I can actually go to that location, see what the satellites detected, and say from the ground what I'm seeing. So we're actually able to, you know, that's another level. Like that's awesome. I said, we're really looking at multiple levels, you know, between boots on the ground as well as, you know, using satellites to monitor forest change and forest loss. So I can ground truth what I'm seeing on the ground. And maybe, you know, the satellite's picking up nothing, or maybe the satellite is picking up, you know, someone doing some illegal logging or something like that. So, and the cool thing is that you can download the alerts when you're connected to the internet go offline, collect your data offline, and then come back, and when you're connected again, sync your phone at that point. And
awesome.
You know, it's pretty seamless for people who are in Uganda who don't have cell service everywhere or, you know, access to Wi-Fi. So really cool way that, you know, there's that feedback loop. And we've also been working with communities like in Tanzania, where one of my favorite things is a dashboard that we created using the Forest Monitor's data and satellite imagery that, you know, many people in the community have access to. So, you know, sometimes you could get into these places where the only people who would have access to the data would be like the government, or it would be the scientists. And the people who are actually doing the very local conservation planning wouldn't necessarily have access to that data. But now there's a shared tool that has all the data in the same place, and all these different groups of people can come together and do shared decision making with the same information, all in one place. That's very visual and shows the GPS coordinates of where that, you know, snare was found, you know, in someone's protected forest area. So
awesome.
Pretty neat use of technology there. And you know, now there's work that's getting into the use of drones for technology. And, you know, even in like, you know, I talked about disease, there's really great new developments that are happening with genomics and DNA and genetics, looking at the paternity of chimps, being able to just take a poop sample and, you know, be able to tell, you know, whose kid a chimp is. And, you know, also using those techniques and technologies for, you know, monitoring disease in chimp communities. So you know, just all different kinds of ways that we can use technology for conservation. So
all right, and this is really interesting. It's really cool to hear how you got to work with a hero of yours and work hard with her on this project. But I wonder, since this is still technically a company, has she ever like acted like a boss, like yelled at you, hey, you didn't put it in your timesheets or something like that?
Have any of you ever been replaced by chimpanzees that can do the same job?
Some days I think that I could probably be replaced by some chimps.
Me too,
by all
man.
Means. yeah, that's not saying much for the chimps. I'm only joking. I'm trying to be self-deprecating, not be offensive to chimps.
Yeah. They're not listening. Don't worry. Our chimp market. We're just not hitting them.
Not the numbers in Tanzania like we like.
Yeah. You know, Jane has such a great sense of humor that, you know, if we ever get reprimanded, it's for, you know, something really silly or something along those lines. I can't say that I've ever really been reprimanded for something totally legitimate.
I just can't picture Jane Goodall like being like super nasty to you guys. I'm like,
no.
But I want to thank you so much for coming on. I could talk to you for another hour, and maybe we'll get you on in the future again. But where can people go to check out the Institute, your work, or interact? I know you got your website's got a ton of stuff on it. So what's the best places to go?
Yeah, so our main website is janegoodall.org. Hopefully that's pretty easy to remember. And I know you're a teacher, so, you know, any other educators like yourself or young people that you work with can check out Roots and Shoots at rootsandshoots.org. That's our website for our youth program. And then, you know, we really have a abundant and really active social media presence. And for the most part, we're Jane Goodall, I-N-S-T, on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. So you can check us out on social media as well.
That's awesome, man. Sean, thank you so much for coming on and giving us a few minutes. And you guys are doing good work out there. So it's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much. Really glad to join you.
Early candidate for a science interview of the year. Right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But we're only week two into
the Verbies. You know, the running is all year long.
Jane Goodall could put on that Wikipedia page, yeah. Verbie 2018
the same
winner.
Year as an Oscar.
She's killing it.
Go.
But I could really talk to that guy for a while because there's so much I didn't even like get to as far as like chimpanzees. I could just talk to him about for a while. So maybe we'll get him on in the future. Definitely. Again too. So and we are on a roll in 2018.
Yeah, it's a good start.
Starting strong, man. And we got a lot of good guests coming on. So what do we got?
Well, we did this early last year, 2017. I think we're going to do it again, Scotty.
We're going to interview Daniel Pessina.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Daniel.
Yeah. We like you.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway.
Scott, you're going to be playing God again because I'm giving you 16 dead celebrities from 2017, and we're going to do a bracket to determine who's coming back to life.
So the bracket was who I want alive again?
Yes. So
wasn't one who I would want my dad to be? Was that a different one?
Yeah, that was a different one. That was in November.
Right, right.
Okay. I think you were Derek Jeter's son in the end.
Yeah, well, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I would still stick with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I want him to be my dad.
Yep.
All right, so who I want back?
Yeah, so I'm going to, just like NCAA tournament, I'm going to give you two
explain
names.
Explain my reasoning.
You give me any reason, whether it's sentimental, whether it's funny, whether it's, I can't think of an answer, so I'm just going to pick one. You just explain it, and they'll move on to the next round until we get to the end, and one person will be coming back to life
all
in
right.
2017.
So let's get some stuff going here. All right.
All right. Your first grouping, Mary Tyler Moore versus Aaron Moran.
Who's the second guy?
Aaron Moran was the sister on Happy Days.
Oh. I'll go Mary Tyler Moore.
Mary Tyler Moore?
Aaron Moran, I know who you're talking about now. Had no actual attachment to. Mary Tyler Moore seemed kind of wholesome, and I think she kind of represented a generation there, and like that name still pops up. And hey, I really loved Weezer back in the day. Ooh, I look just like Buddy Holly. And you're Mary Tyler Moore. So,
for song lyric purposes.
Song lyric purposes.
All right.
Mary Tyler Moore.
All right. Some veterans in the TV game that people love. Judge Joseph Wapner from the People's Court versus Adam West.
Adam West.
A.W.
Listen, I never really got into the People's Court. I remember he was always kind of like the joke, like Judge Wapner. But Adam West, I do remember having times watching those Batman marathons and getting into that show. I remember specifically being on vacation, like on a hotel, and like that was the only thing on and really enjoying it. So Adam West seemed like an interesting dude also that I would have loved to talk to on the show. Judge Wapner too, but Adam West first.
All right. We got some musical legends in this matchup. Chuck Berry versus Tom Petty.
Tom Petty.
Kind of figured that.
As I discussed on the show, when he was one of the few celebrity deaths to actually be like, oh, man. Like, it kind of, not that I was depressed about it, but
we talked about it the first time he died versus the real time he died.
I know. Like 3 days before or something like that. But I really liked Tom Petty's music. His greatest hits was a big thing. Alex really likes the Traveling Wilburys. It kind of bothered me. Chuck Berry, no, sorry, buddy, nothing wrong with you. I liked your music. Big influence on rock and roll itself. Tom Petty, just way too young. I would love to bring him back for 30 more years.
All right. A couple comedians in this round. Don Rickles versus Charlie Murphy.
That's the toughest one so far. Because here's the thing, like, if I bring God back, how much time does he have? like, if I bring back Rickles, I feel like I'm only getting, like, a year on my investment.
Mm-hmm.
funny, razor-sharp Don Rickles. Like, am I bringing him back when it's prime, or am I just getting, like, old, crappy Don Rickles?
Well, we never really had rules to this, so I guess
we'll make him up on the spot, damn it.
Well, you are God in this scenario, so you can bring him back at a younger age.
Okay, so I gotta bring him back, like, when I want him.
Yeah.
Charlie Murphy was funny, though.
He's probably gonna be a great guest for the show.
I know. And then the way I hear, like, I listen to some, you know, Rogan's podcast and a couple of ones, and the way they talk about him, I say he was just an amazing dude. But I'm gonna go Rickles.
All right.
Just for the sheer opportunity of maybe one day I'd get to talk to a legend of that status. Listen, Charlie Murphy is a legend in his own way. But not in stand-up comedy like Don Rickles.
Yeah.
So I'm bringing back Rickles.
All right. Another couple of musicians here. Fats Domino versus Malcolm Young.
I don't have much connection to either of them. So on name alone, I'm bringing back Fats Domino.
All right. All right. Just because you like the nickname Fats, he gets to live.
I mean, yeah, that's good enough reason. Sure.
All right. All right. Roy Halladay versus Chris Cornell.
All right. Reasoning on choosing this is I'm choosing by their death. I'm going to bring Roy Halladay back.
All right.
Roy Halladay was a pitcher that I always wanted the Mets to get. Always wanted. And there was a lot of rumors. Like, when you guys got him, there was a lot of rumors the Mets were going to go after him.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of my favorite pitchers to watch. And he didn't technically kill himself on purpose.
Yeah.
Listen, I don't want to hear anybody's tweets or anything like, oh, because Cornell. No, it's extremely sad and something terrible to deal with. But Roy Halladay died in a plane, not meaning it. Chris Cornell meant it. So maybe I bring him back to life and he just kills himself in a year. Bad return on investment.
Damn it! I just brought you back!
I had all this power. I could have Tom Petty!
I can only do this once a year. You do know this. That's why John Glenn is still around.
So I don't trust Cornell with my pick. So, well. Roy Halladay.
Well, this might make the next one easier then, because it's Jerry Lewis versus Chester Bennington.
Jerry Lewis. I never liked Chester Bennington.
I know.
So,
I knew this would be an easy one, but looking at the names. Well, you know what? Let me replace a name since I had a couple here. I'm going to do the comedian Ralphie May versus Jerry Lewis.
Jerry Lewis.
Jerry Lewis.
Ralphie May, I think, is a very talented comedian. Wasn't a gigantic fan or really into him. Like not by choice or anything, just was never into him. Chester Bennington, of course. Let me reframe. I think it's extremely sad of the family he left behind and everything like that. But I was just never a fan
kids?
Of his six or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm just never a fan of Linkin Park and that kind of whole vibe. So Jerry Lewis.
All right. And the final one in the first round, Hugh Hefner versus Dick Enberg.
I want to bring back Hugh Hefner just for the stories. I would love to interview him.
Mm.
Dick Enberg, you know, I feel like he has more of like a one trick pony. Like I kind of know his like thing, but Hugh Hefner was kind of had a mysterious thing about him. And I think that's kind of why he was so, well known.
All right.
So yeah, I'm all confident right. with my picks.
All right. So we're going to move on to the next round then,
ooh.
Scotty.
Ooh.
That was this, the semifinals or quarterfinals. Mary Tyler Moore versus Adam West.
Adam West. I had more just personal connection alone. I actually watched Batman. Mary Tyler Moore was a little old school before my time a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So Adam West.
All right. Let me just have the category. Boom. All right. Tom Petty versus Don Rickles.
Wow. That's like Steelers Patriots in the wild card round.
Yeah.
That's big.
Mm.
Again, I'm gonna run with personal connection because I think that's most important. I'm gonna go Tom Petty.
All right.
Again, really enjoyed his music. Rickles loved him, but I feel like you know he was a little bit before our time. So we're here with the YouTube videos, and we can watch him. But like, was there ever a modern connection with Rickles? Not really.
Yeah.
Where Petty, I could have went and saw him and stuff. So that's my well thought out answer.
All right. Name boy, Fats Domino versus Roy Holiday.
Is that like a straw boy?
Nothing's like a straw boy.
I can't think of enough reasons for Fats Domino to come back. I'm sorry, Fats. I love you. But I guess Roy, because you were one of my favorite pitchers of all time. So.
All right. Jerry Lewis versus Hugh Hefner. Couple legends there.
I was going to say, yeah, definitely like old white legends right there. In support of comedy, I'm going to go Jerry Lewis.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. I mean, Hugh was probably Me Too'd a million times.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm going to go with Jerry Lewis, those telethons and all his years and the, you know, in Vegas and that old comedy stories, I think would be maybe more interesting than to sustain like a 60 something year career doing it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm going with him.
All right. So now we're in the semifinals and we got Adam West versus Tom Petty.
We're going to go with Tom Petty.
Mm.
Again, Adam West had like a minimal connection to me because it's a Batman thing, but I really listened to Tom Petty's music a lot. So,
all right. And then on the other side, Roy Holiday versus Jerry Lewis.
This music is awful. let's go with... I'm going to go with Jerry Lewis. Here's why. I think Roy's riding on like, you know, I had a little sympathy for him, but now at this far into the tournament, like, it's like, all right.
Just Roy. On interest.
Yeah,
alone.
Yeah. I'm like, Roy, well, you know. Yeah. I think, like, Jerry Lee Lewis, Jerry Lewis, if I can get him on the podcast, would be more interesting than Roy Holiday.
Mm.
Way more, in, like, something that I can connect with than just being dominant in baseball and, like, amazing. And, hey, I read about the plane that Roy Holiday bought. Mm. Apparently the owner, the guy who created the plane, died in a plane crash. So...
coincidence.
Yeah. Do your research, Roy. Do your research.
All right, Scott, we have two people remaining. You being God, you can only bring one back. Scott, what are you going to do? Are we getting Tom Petty's music or Jerry Lewis's comedy back?
I am playing God, so I could bring them back at any point in their career. And I didn't want to go chalk, like picking Duke and North Carolina in the tournament. Like, you know, everyone make fun of people who do that.
Now, before you answer, what was a harder decision, this one or John Glenn versus Kimbo Slice from last year?
Kimbo Slice, man. Because I don't care about Kimbo Slice or John Glenn, really.
But you kept on saying the podcast with Kimbo Slice would have been insane.
Yes. He would be a dream guest for the podcast.
Yeah.
Now I'm faced with Lewis and Petty, both amazing guests for the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But here's my thinking. I had one more personal connection with Petty.
Mm-hmm.
Not personal connection. I listened to Tom Petty. Jerry Lewis, I didn't really watch his comedy. I know that he was gigantic and a legend, but if you asked me to name a Jerry Lewis bit, I can just remember like that. Hey! Like the faces and the marathon
basically
being
what everybody imitates Jerry Lewis as.
Right. So I'm trying to at least give a good argument and just not pick Tom Petty. But if we're going to be honest on the show, we always are. I got to go Tom Petty, Mike.
All right.
I got to go Tom Petty.
So, astronaut John Glenn and Tom Petty are back on the planet.
Whew. Well, John Glenn might be on another planet.
Mm. Oh, I saw what you did there. We don't need Jerry Lewis. We have your comedy.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to next year. Hopefully not as many people die, but we need 16 of you.
We need a lot of celebrity deaths and sexual harassments.
We need 16 people to kick the bucket. So, Bert, let's get out of here. Anything to promote?
I'm going to go to TecmoBowlShirts.com. Again, our buddies at Tecmo Madison, they sent us over some free shirts. They sell these shirts that have the emblems from the old Tecmo Bowl days, if you all recall, with both the old school teams and the new school teams. They're really awesome. Go to Tecmo BowlShirts.com and pick some up.
All right. Our good friends, Rich McDonald and Joe Carney, are doing a big comedy show this, I believe it's this weekend, but it's Stand Up Against Hate, Sunday, January 14th, 2018. It's a full day of comedy. There's a family comedy show at 2, then Stand Up at 5, and then McDonald Carney at 7. There's a lot of comic friends on the show. It's at the Crossroads in Garwood, so I'm going to promote McDonald and Carney. Go check them out. Proceeds benefit Garden State Equality. It's just a good cause. So with that, guys, keep sharing the podcast. Mm-hmm. Keep listening to the podcast. Mm-hmm. Keep commenting. Following us on Instagram and reviews on iTunes. All that stuff helps. If you want a T-shirt, please contact us, and we'll send you out a T-shirt no matter where you are. Yeah. We'll get it to you. I guess other than that, guys, just keep sharing it with your friends. That's the most important thing. And send us a message. Tell us you dig this. So with that, guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.